So I'm talking to Wendy here at the Pearl table. So how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. A bit tired.
Yes, it's very, very tiring. There's lots of people around. You, just to describe the table, there will be pictures in the show notes. You've got the camels, you've got all the books, you've got loads of stuff to give away. You've got the tuets, which are round, so that you can get round to it. So what is the purpose for you, or what's the benefit for you of coming over here? You're just telling me that you're selling these books, and you're selling them at cost. That's a bad business model.
I made money using Pearl. And my partner and me, we made so much money using Pearl that we don't have to work anymore. We are wealthy. And we can support the Pearl community and the rest of the open source community for the rest of our lives. And that's what we're doing. And we think we're going to give something back. So we buy books, and the publisher charges us the cost price plus transport costs, and that's the price that we sell them for.
That's fantastic, and you've got a wide, wide range of Pearl. So just in case there's anybody on the show that doesn't know what Pearl is, can you tell us what Pearl is?
Pearl is a dynamic, open source, free software programming language. It's 26 years old now. You can use it for everything, and it has been used for everything, ranging from making a booking reservation system like booking.com to things for Amazon, eBay, Marketplace, big scripts, large scripts. Very small scripts. I've got a book here about one-liners. You can use it for everything, and it is being used for everything. I even know people that make games with it, interactive games, text games. I know people who make graphical programs with it. So, yeah, you can use it for everything.
It's not the most easy programming language to learn in the world. How would you say to that?
I think you're wrong. It's one of the easier programming languages to learn. Certainly if you compare it to Java or C. I've got a book in front of me that teaches you the beginning Pearl, that teaches you Pearl in such a way that you don't have to be a programmer when you start reading it. And at the end, you will be able to make an automated response to DMCA takedown notices.
Whoa, very impressive. Yes. What book would that be, pray? Beginning Pearl by Curtis Ovid Pooh. I have Teach Yourself Pearl in 24 Hours, an excellent book.
Indeed. Before Curtis Poe wrote his Beginning Pearl, I always recommended Teach Yourself Programming Pearl in 24 Hours. I always advise that because it's so easily written. It reads like a novel, and at the end you know a lot of Pearl. But Beginning Pearl, it goes wider and it goes deeper. Wider in subjects and deeper in material that you learn. Yeah, thank you.
I'll buy that in a minute. So is there anything, you're involved, you're living the life that many of us would like, and you're still involved in the Pearl community. How you wrote on your thing that you're a Pearl developer. Where did the thing go? Oh, I'm losing stuff. I'm losing it here now, folks. It doesn't matter. We'll get it in a minute. So you're still a Pearl developer?
No, I've never been a Pearl developer. I was a Pearl scripter. From 1994 to 2001, I was the boss of a website building company, XXLink, in the Netherlands. We were the first company building websites there in 94. And I made little scripts. And, well, medium-sized scripts. But I was never a good programmer. My partner, she's the real super nerd. She makes modules for CPAN. She has been one of the core developers of Booking.com, changing the system. She speaks at conferences and stuff. I am doing the marketing, I'm doing the personnel stuff, I'm doing the bookkeeping and everything else. I'm the more creative of the two.
Yeah.
So I'm searching for little camels because of the camel is the logo of Pearl. I'm looking for companies that can make stickers and buttons for me, and I buy books and I negotiate deals with publishers like, what reduction do you give me? Because I'm selling to the Pearl community, so etc. So that's what I'm doing. And I'm bringing people together. That's what I'm doing.
So have you read all these books? Because one thing that I've noticed about trying to pick a good Pearl book is I never know where to start. And everybody recommends, get the O'Reilly books. But to be honest, it's like jumping into a swimming pool, not knowing how to swim.
Well, you see behind me two cupboards filled with Pearl books, and that's the largest library of Pearl books in the world. I've collected that collection. It's over 1,000 books, and they're all different. And I've got all the Dutch language Perl books. I've got 95 of all the English language Perl books, and I'm now starting to get the original French and German Perl books, which are not translations of English books. I'm not getting them. And if I recommend you a book, I would recommend, if you start learning Perl, start reading Beginning Perl. And if you already know Perl, start reading Modern Perl, because don't use Perl the old way with confiscated obfuscated Perl. Yes, Perl is not line noise anymore. Perl can be gentle and elegant and short and readable. And I've seen many, many examples of that, of people that left the old ways and make it better nowadays. So Modern Perl.
Cool. Is there anything else that that you want to talk to us about that's coming up in the Perl community, especially here locally?
Well, one of the buttons that we have says Perl is very much alive.
Yes.
And one of the things of having a booth at Vosdem is that every now and then somebody who thinks he's funny and original comes by and says, Perl is dead. And then I look at him, and I look at the table, and I look at all the volunteers around me, and I think, Perl is not dead, Perry. Perl is so very much alive. We've got over 100 user groups in Europe alone, and all those user groups come together at least once a month for dinner and technical talks. And many of those people cooperate in improving modules, in improving the core of Perl, in organizing hackathons, for instance. A hackathon is a hacker's marathon. And we sit together for 2, 3, 4 days and fix problems that people have reported. Well, that's alive, as far as I know.
Sounds good to me. Listen, I'm going to let you get back to it. Actually, I'm not. I'm going to hang up this, and then I'm going to pick out a nice Perl book for myself. And I'll talk to you later. Thanks very much for the interview.
You're welcome, and thank you for asking.
Hi everybody, this is Ken again. I'm up here on K2 at Vosdem 2014, and I'm talking to Frederick. How are you doing, Frederick?
Fine, thanks.
What project are you here talking about today?
Well, GBus community, which regroup lots of projects, more than 40, I think. So mainly we are talking about the container, the GE6 container, which is AES7, but well, we can talk about RHQ, Qubit, GBPM, whatever kind of project. But
okay, so what is JBoss Application Server 7 then?
So it's a GE6 container. So what it is, it's I would say a group of different kind of modules based on the GVM, and then instead of reinventing the wheel, there's different modules offer you the opportunity to use communication between application, improve the security, and so on and so far. So you will not have to develop this kind of stuff in your application. You will have to focus on what the application should do.
Yeah. Okay. So this is for deploying Java applications in a web server environment.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. And what other projects do you have under your So you're a solution architect for Red Hat.
Yeah.
So businesses would come to you and say, okay, help me out here.
Yeah, for example, one really known, I would say, problem that customer has is related to the business process management.
Okay.
And GBPM, for example, on the community side, is responding to that needs. That means that you can, I would say, create some processes and assign application to each step of that processes. So that's one of...
What is Qubit then?
Qubit is working on a standard protocol, which is it's a kind of messaging, I would say, solution. It's working on a MQP protocol. So if you are working on a GMS, you've got two applications and they have to communicate together. So you are going to use a module named GMS. But GMS is a norm on the application side, but norm not on, I would say, the protocol side, the communication between the two applications. And so Qubit permits you to use the IMQP protocol, which is a standard, and then you can choose whatever kind of agent coming from whatever kind of provider.
Do you have any other projects that you're supporting? Well, we cover everything here.
No, we can talk about other kind of project, but well, it's.
Goes on and on.
For example, InfiniSpan, it's a way to externalize the cache in your application. Then you will not have to, I would say, pay attention of the cache propagation between different applications. It's already done by, I would say, InfiniSpan, so you do not have to take care of this. Well, there is other, but I do not have in my mind. So.
And is this something that the hacker community gets involved in, the development community gets involved in quite a lot?
Yeah. I mean, there is different, I would say, for example, the project Application Server Set 7, sorry, is, I would say, a bundle which contains a lot of different kind of projects. For example, Hibernate, for example, I would say PicketLink or PicketBox. And all of these modules, all of these modules are managed by different community, which are not, it's not mandatory that they will be linked together. So the goal of the Application Server 7 community is to gather all together and to respond to the specification of GE6.
Okay. So what new stuff is coming out next year in the short term?
Well, I think that the next one is Wildfly, which will be probably GE7 compliant. So that's the next major one. Otherwise, maybe GBPM is also a new thing because it's going to bring BAM to the GBPM world. So, yeah.
Anything else that I missed in the interview?
No, that's fine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Hi everybody, this is Ken. I'm on K2 at FOSDEM 2014. I'm at the Open Office booth and I'm talking to
Olivier.
I'm from Hamburg, Germany.
Yeah.
I'm working for IBM at the Apache Open Office project.
Yeah.
And I'm here at FOSDEM to meet all the open source people enthusiastic about making all these stuff and software available for free for everybody so they can use it. Yes, don't have to stick on a certain vendor or something like this. And it's incredible to see how patience the people are here working together. Also how friendly it is even between different Linux distros or even with Apache Open Office and LibreOffice. So the booth is right beside us. Yesterday we had an dev room together on office productivity, also on the open document file format, which is our both native file format. And yes, it's amazing event to be here and to be part of these open source development stuff.
Just so the people know, OpenOffice is coming from StarOffice, which was a Sun project.
Yes.
And it's an alternative office suite to something like Microsoft Office.
Yeah.
I know there was a lot of questions about the split off of OpenOffice and LibreOffice, but I see here that you're mentioning that you're co-developing, doing development talks. So how is the community going to continue? Do you think there'll be more cooperation, or will the projects move apart?
OpenOffice now at Apache, so we are at an Apache license, and at Apache we have a certain rules regarding the software from third-party stuff that we can use regarding the licensing. LibreOffice is started on GPL, what the main OpenOffice was before it was donated to Apache. Now they are on MPL. They had rebased on the Apache license to do the relicensing on MPL. So we have currently a little bit problems of getting back the stuff that is doing on the LibreOffice into the Apache OpenOffice. But the other way around, it's quietly happily that the LibreOffice has their mirror of the Apache OpenOffice repository in their repository. They are cherry-picking the stuff, and that's what Apache software projects are about, so making open-source software for the public good for every use. So it's great to see that not only my stuff that I'm doing at Apache OpenOffice is now used or downloaded by, I think today we have 90 million downloads since we are at Apache, since our first release in May 2012, and also used by the LibreOffice users. So I have no problem there. I'm not, as a developer, as an open source developer, being paid for it is a good thing, and so I don't have to care about protecting what I'm programming. So I'm just open source, and everybody can use it, so I have no problem. Currently, just taking what LibreOffice is doing is not possible for the Apache project because of the licensing stuff. So in this way, there is we need more corporations, and the Dev Room showed that we can work together on project and on ideas, but on the coding it needs to be evolved, and let's see what the future will bring here.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I
don't. Quite often these things tend to work themselves out in time.
Yeah.
So what new stuff is happening on the open office
front?
What new stuff is happening? It's quite hard. We are evolving. We are new at Apache and settle us down. We are getting things right now. A lot of languages are coming up. Every release we have 5 or 6 more. We are doing some stuff regarding the build system to get it easier. In the former days, it's not easy, and LibreOffice has did quite well job in their build system. We are trying to do the same here. Projects are going on. Integration, especially for Windows developers into integrated development environments like Eclipse and Visual Studio are ongoing. And then, yes, just bug fixing, little features. We are currently on feature freeze for our next release, 4.1. We will planning to bring out a beta, I think, hopefully in 3 or 4 weeks to have some kind more people looking at it and to have the final version ready at the end of the quarter, beginning of April, something like this.
Okay. How long have you been working on the OpenOffice code?
I joined Sun Microsystems in summer of 2002,
yeah.
Mostly involved in the word processing component. And in December of 2006, I joined the OASIS Open Document TC for the standardization of the file format. So I'm also on the standardization here.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, I hope so. And yes, and then there was the change regarding Oracle acquiring, and they are no longer interested in supporting the open office. And so I have got the good possibility to be employed by IBM to continue my work, because it's a great project. It's when I started there, I was formerly working on a small team, just doing project work where 10 people are using my software. And then I came to OpenOffice and millions of people are using your software. They're giving feedback, and they're giving you all feedback. Some people are pissed when you have put a bug in it, and they blame you for it. But then again, when you fix it, they are come back, and it's incredible that so many people are using OpenOffice and LibreOffice and all the other variants that we have on this code base. There's also Oxygen and all this stuff. Also the people that are making the Mac port and at the beginning and so on. So it's really, really great that office productivity is not stick to the one on the major software that is out there.
Okay. Well, we have quite a lot of people who are who use accessibility tools in order to use LibreOffice, and they say that the Orca screen reader project has sometimes difficulty reading some of the OpenOffice applications. Do you? What would be the best way that we could try and convince developers like yourself to spend more time on accessibility issues?
Yeah, we had recently for the Windows platform integrated the iAccessible 2 work that IBM is formerly doing on their own fork that was called Symfony, and that is now integrated and will be part of the next release. I forgot to mention it. So this is only for the Windows platform.
Yeah.
All the ATK stuff that was started at the OpenOffice project, I think former days, and I think Michael Beeks made the first stuff here and Quell and so on. I don't know. Currently, I see no focus on our development community to focus on the Linux side of accessibility and on ATK supporting APIs, but I think it depends on how much demand is coming in. And also, yes, we are driven by volunteers, what they want to do, and also companies that investing, and if they have demand to support these kind of accessibility stuff here.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because the guys are unable to use the software because it's inaccessible, so they can't, you know, we want to be able to get them to a point where they can start contributing code to the project, but they can't get involved in the project because of the accessibility issues. So now that I have your business card, I know exactly who to contact about bugs.
A colleague integrated the stuff regarding Windows. I was in the former days little involved in the accessibility part for the Linux platforms, but it's long ago. And as I said, currently I see no effort in the Apache Open Office community regarding this. But there are some people that are coming up. I think there's one from the Netherlands, Christoph Stube, that is sometimes around also in the LibreOffice project. And we recently started some kind of call to, as we see that the LibreOffice is picking up the iAccessible 2 integration, we let more or less an open letter to at least cooperate on these stuff, accessibility for these projects, just to get, if they made fixes in the iAccessible 2 stuff that has been integrated in OpenOffice, contributed back, that would be a nice thing. So LibreOffice is doing good things, and taking what we are doing is a good stuff because our stuff is more used. It would be great if just the bug fixes in the parts that they have cherry-picked contributed back. That would be really great first step for further both way cooperation.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Is there anything else that you want to talk to me about, or have we covered most of the things? How can, if there are anyone out there who wants to contribute to the Open Office project, what's the best way to get involved in the community?
Yeah, the best is to get involved is to come to the dev list. We have some kind of websites set up where you have some kind of orientation modules, so for different interests, for QA people, for development. And it's depending on you need some patience currently. So it's the LibreOffice people are doing a lot of work on mentoring new people. They are more. We had to found our new home at Apache, not so much people to be as responsive as we would be. But when you come to the dev list, never give up. We will help you with building your first open office on the platform you want to work on. And we are currently working on better integration into EDE. So just come there, speak up there. It's open and transparent. Or our dev list is the first place to go. Always when somebody steps up, couple of hours later, he's pointed to the right direction where he gets the orientation. So.
And there's no reason why somebody can't contribute to both projects.
Yeah, no problem. We have people that are contributing to both projects.
Yeah.
Just an example, Regina Henschel, a German teacher, is contributing to LibreOffice, already source code, and to Apache OpenOffice, keeping the stuff together in this area where she is interested in, so no problem.
Okay. Listen, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to go down and interview your competitors.
No problem.
Hi, this is Ken again. FOSDEM 2014, K Building, Level 2, Extreme End, Elasticsearch. And you are?
Hi, I'm Honza Kral. I'm the Python guy for Elasticsearch, the company behind Elasticsearch, Kibana, and Logstash.
I have never seen these projects before in my life. What do they do? Distributed RESTful search and analysis.
Yes, so that's Elasticsearch. That's basically our flagship product. That's also why the company is named the same.
Yeah.
And it's a distributed data store based on Apache Lucene that does search and analytics with your data. It's as it says, RESTful. So everything we do over HTTP, and we do it with JSON. So if you index documents, it's JSON. If you run queries, the queries are also JSON. It's distributed, so it scales quite well over horizontally across many machines. That ties well into the use case with Logstash, because Logstash is a centralized logging solution. So imagine you have a bunch of servers and you just want to aggregate all the logs from all the services running on all those servers.
How is that different from SysLogNG or something?
So SysLogNG also only does part of it. It will absolutely aggregate the logs into one place, but it's sometimes difficult to set up, and it's still very platform specific. Logstash is more open, more configurable. It's basically an open pipeline. You can think of it also as an ETL tool to extract data from somewhere, transform it on the way, enrich it, parse it, put it into a unified format, and load it into a data store of your choice, be it flat files, Elasticsearch, MongoDB, whatever.
Okay.
So, and the benefit you get if you decide to load it into Elasticsearch is you get Kibana, which is a JavaScript front end for Elasticsearch that was developed specifically to be used with data from Logstash, although it can be used for other data as well. And that will give you easy search and discovery over your logs, including pretty pictures and graphs for those who want it. That will enable you to easily discover what's actually going on, see on one glance all the anomalies that's happening in your environment.
So imagine, for instance, in a world where there are lots of API calls going around to different machines, and they all report various different things. Product X goes in here, and it becomes Product X is recognized and comes back as Product Y. Would it be possible to trace all that sort of stuff using this system?
Absolutely. That's one of our biggest use cases. When people want to aggregate data from different systems, what you described is a little extreme use case. We can keep it much simpler. You have a logs from your database, from your web application, from your web server, and your load balancer. And you want to see what's going on. You see a spike on your database. Does it correspond with a spike on your load balancer and is everything okay? Or is there a spike on your load balancer and nothing gets through to your application? Like, this is something that you can see on one glance. No need to discover anything. No need to log into four different machines, do a grep, and then try to parse the different time formats that different log formats use.
Yes, that is actually horrible, because the only true log time format is ISO 8601. As everybody listening to Hacker Public Radio knows, because I've said it many, many times.
Okay.
But is this then more for system administration as opposed to using it to manage a complex API-driven environment?
So Logstash started from the operations point of view.
Yeah.
Elasticsearch itself is just a generic data store, so that's used all over the spectrum. With Logstash and Kibana, it's always discover what's going on in your environment and anything. And people have started using it for other things which we didn't foresee in the beginning. People realize that log is nothing but just a document that has a date time,
yep,
that is a timestamp. So people started using actually Logstash to index Twitter stream or stuff like that, where the same logic applies. You're just consuming some stream of data that have a timestamp. You're analyzing it or parsing it, enriching the data, and loading it into your target data store.
How difficult is it? What sort of underlying knowledge would you need to have to configure this?
It's not that hard. If you just want to get started, you download Logstash. It's just one jar file that you can run. It will even start its own embedded Elasticsearch with Kibana installed, so you can get up and running very quickly. If you want to just start consuming data, let's say from standard input, the simplest possible example, you can definitely get there within half an hour from absolute zero knowledge to looking up Logstash, downloading it, and getting through to this example.
Okay, and the third component is what now?
The third component mentioned there is Hadoop, which basically just advertises that we do integration with Hadoop. We have a package called Elasticsearch Hadoop that lets you load data from Hadoop into Elasticsearch, and also lets you use Elasticsearch as a backend for some of the Hadoop integrated solutions like Hive and Pig.
What's Hadoop?
Okay. Hadoop is... That's a hard question. So
that's why I'm here.
I'm not a Hadoop person per se, but Hadoop is an environment for doing distributed batch processing.
Okay.
So it comes from the very beginning, where you have HDFS as a distributed file system. On top of you have the MapReduce system, which is the original Hadoop, which is a framework to doing MapReduce jobs in a distributed environment.
Okay, good answer, and a very cool logo, if I might say so myself.
Yes. So it's the elephant that's they have a whole theme going around it with Hive being the elephant disguised as a bee or something like that. They
okay. Cool. Anything else that I need to know about?
Everything is, of course, open source. BSD 2, Apache 2 licensed. We do offer, as a company, training and support for those who want it. Otherwise, everything is all the information is available on the website, elasticsearch.org, yep. And elasticsearch.com for the company.
Anything new coming up in the coming time?
So, glad you asked. We are actually releasing currently the 1.0 version of Elasticsearch that should come out in the next few weeks, which is January 2014. And that will, as the number would suggest, it's our stable version. We are breaking some backwards compatibility in order to be able to move boldly towards future.
Future, yes.
The new future. We dedicated ourselves to not break backwards compatibility again, okay. At least until the next major version, which is not planned currently, we should be fine there. We're introducing a lot of new cool features, including reworked of the aggregations framework to do cool aggregations inside of Elasticsearch, Snapshot Restore, which is a very nice and clean API to do backing up of your entire cluster. To other arbitrary storage, for example, S3, local file system, or aforementioned HDFS. And some other generic improvements like the CAT API and everything. Along with that, we also released last week, actually, our first commercial product, which is Marvel. Marvel is a plugin for Elasticsearch. It just lets you monitor what's going on inside of your cluster. And even historically, like what's the typical question, what happened yesterday at 3 a.m.?
And is that open source?
That's not open source. That's a commercial product. It's free for development, but it's closed source. And in production, it costs $500 for 5 nodes per year. So it's nothing too crazy, but it's definitely no open source. But to be also fair, we don't have any special hooks in Elasticsearch itself for this to work. We're just using the publicly available APIs. There's nothing stopping you from taking the exact same APIs, feed the data into Graphite or any other solution, and do everything yourself. Yep. This is just basically a prepackaged solution for people who don't want that or are not familiar with Elasticsearch enough to know what to monitor for.
Okay, well, I think I know enough. There'll be links to everything in the show notes along with a picture of the board here. And thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, this is Ken at FOSDEM 2013, K-Building Level 2, and after talking to the openoffice.org folks, I wanted to come down here and talk to the LibreOffice guys to see if what they said was true or not. So I'm talking to Cor. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. It's an interesting booth and fair, and lots of people that come around and talk about the software, and we have nice hoodies, so it's really complete.
So you're here on the booth, you're basically pimping LibreOffice for everybody.
Yes.
So yesterday there was also a development session where you and OpenOffice and several other people were involved in progressing the desktop. What were you involved in that?
No, I was not involved in the sessions. That was the ODF room. Yep. I was not involved at that. I was at the booth the whole day.
Okay.
Yes.
So just in case there's anyone out there that doesn't know what LibreOffice is, I wonder, could you give them the spiel on what it is?
Yes. Well, LibreOffice is a fully functional office suite. With spreadsheet, word processor, presentation, drawing tools, maths, and a lot of extension. And it's a great community around LibreOffice that makes it really fast and speed development, things like that.
Okay.
And of course, it's available on all Linux distributions by default, and it's on Windows and Macintosh. And
Since the split from OpenOffice to LibreOffice, I think we were talking about that earlier on, that there was a Oracle, for one reason or another, decided to let it go. So probably best not to focus on that so much. Yeah. But do you see that you're picking up
users on the Windows side as much as you have done on the Linux side?
It's obvious that most of the users of LibreOffice are Windows users. Most people outside there use Windows, so it's obviously that there are more Windows users than Linux users with LibreOffice.
Okay.
Yes, I'm sure.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So, what are the plans for LibreOffice development in the coming year? Are you privy to that?
Sorry.
What's new in LibreOffice in the coming year? What can we expect to be released?
Okay. Ja, je knipt wel, hè?
Ja, het knipt wel dit.
Hier, moet je het er even bij hebben, het kleine gat.
Ja, ik pak wel even alles erbij.
Ja, er zijn maar heel weinig kleine muntjes, ja. Of kleine briefjes. Gewoon wat aan is te komen, wat aan zit te komen.
Ja.
Oké.
Okay.
Yes. Nu even over nadenken. Daar zat zoveel. Yes, oké. Okay.
So what stuff is coming up in LibreOffice in the coming year?
Yes, there's some heavy work going on the user dialogues, and there's a new way to handle them so that it can be easy resizable, and that's close to finish. So users will see that it's a better interface. There's a work going on many speed improvements in Calc with different processors. And we always focus on better interoperability with DocX, XLSX, the Microsoft XML formats. So stuff like that is definitely a focus. And we have two new releases a year, main releases. And every month there are smaller bug fix releases. So there's a high speed of all kind of larger and smaller stuff that's coming in the project.
Do you feel things are settling down a little bit more now that you've been going for a little while and all the backlog of changes have come in?
No. There's nothing settling down.
Full steam ahead.
Yes, it's really speedy development, and you see more people are involved in QA and more people are helping with localization, and more people are doing development, larger chunks, smaller chunks. So it's really rush ahead, and there's so many things that are just good to add new functions, but also so many things that we already improved over the past year. So we're still running ahead, but it's fun just because it's a huge team. And people join, and it makes work just fun because you share it.
Okay, cool. There's one thing that I have to ask is there are quite a lot of accessibility issues with running LibreOffice. Some of our listeners have tried to run it, and they have problem with speech readers. Is there a way that we can kind of push the development so that we can make it a lot more accessible than it currently is?
I don't know to what specific version the people you talk about refer, but in the latest release, just 3 days old, there is as an experimental feature. Is the accessibility code that comes from IBM that had developed it some 7 years ago. And in that time, they promised to give it to the OpenOffice.org project. So finally, it landed on the code base. But it is marked as experimental in our code, in our user interface, on purpose, because we know there are some issues with it. So I'm not... If people run in that issues, I'm not surprised. We know that there are issues. And it's also when you look to Bugzilla, where bugs are reported, you see that developers work on it. So though I'm not a developer and I'm not able to tell people what they should do, I just expect that in the next main release, the real problems will be ironed out, and maybe also in the coming bug fix releases, that a lot of problems will be solved. That's my honest expectation.
That is fantastic news, and we're all glad to hear this. You wear many hats. This business card that you give me, what hat is that?
That is that I'm a member of the membership committee honestly, at the moment I'm chairman of the membership committee, but one of the members, and LibreOffice, it is developed, owned by the Document Foundation. Yep. And if you want to be a member, it's not that you say, oh, I pay 20 or 10 euros a year. You can only become a member if you truly contribute in QA, in development, in marketing or whatever stuff. If you are a member of the community, you can become a member of the Document Foundation. Okay. And there's the little committee, the membership committee, that handles the applications and that every year reviews people who are a member. Are they still active? Do they have the right to be a member? That's our job. One of our jobs. And for the rest, that's an official title, and for the rest I contribute to QA and a bit of localization and marketing stuff.
How did you start doing this? What led you to be in? Did you just get annoyed one day and decide to contribute?
No, it was back in 2004 I started a company dedicated to support to give support with openoffice.org in that time. That was back in 2004, based in the Netherlands. And I still do that. My company grows a bit, and so it exists for 10 years now. But when I started to do that, I found it natural to look at the project and to contribute. So I've been doing that along in openoffice.org, and with the split, when we decided in 2010 that it was good to have something new, I joined. I was one of the people who set up the Document Foundation, and all those 10 years I've been active in the community.
Okay, so, very good.
Yeah.
Have you been involved in the push to get the ODF, behind the ODF format as well? Or did
Sorry.
That... were you involved in the ODF format as well?
Oh, no, in Oasis... Nee. Misschien wil je de vraag even kort herhalen om mooi te kunnen knippen, of niet?
Nee.
Maakt niet uit.
Ik knip niks.
Oh!
It's going out. Guys, this is going out unedited.
Nee, never mind. No. I've not been involved in ODF development Oasis. No.
Okay.
No. I'm just, because of my skills and my daily work, I'm involved in end user support, problems to make all those things work. And the whole ODF, while it's considerably important, and I do explain it to the people, but the work behind it, it's not something I contribute to.
Okay. So you're out there on the front line. Do you support businesses mostly, or
yes.
is it?
Yes, it's business administration, non-profit organizations.
So you're making money on
on
supporting free software.
Yes, obviously. Yes.
So there is a business model out there.
Yeah, there's
people.
A business model. Yes. But you have to. The fun is if you know the software, if you know how a community works, how the product works. That gives you extra strength, but you have to be able to translate it, to transform that into a language that people in business understand.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to look what people need and to offer that. But if you can do that with any software, of course, there's business.
So what do you do? Do you go into a business and say, hey, I can run LibreOffice instead of Microsoft Office, and I'll support training or what?
No, usually people find our company via the web, and because they look for alternatives for running Microsoft Office. And then, depending on their knowledge or their needs, the number of seats in the company, we just talk and we see what we can do. But sometimes it's a short help, sometimes it's a large project with lots of different phases in it.
So. And is it mostly given user training, or would it be there be an end goal to the project?
It's user training that's provided. It is automation of documents or handy stuff to help people. It is templates. It's also helping the system administrators with all configuration of the product. And it's also helping to run the product smoothly from the initial phase where you do some
Pilots.
Yes, we do some looking for the way. Well, when you're in pilots or some analysis before that, communicating with users, getting the right information from your users that you need in all those projects. In this, so it's quite a broad offering.
So have you experienced any hostility that people are forced to use a LibreOffice product as opposed to Microsoft Office, or has that decision already been taken? Are you coming in after that?
No. Obviously, not all people are happy with it. There's always the hurdle that using free software is about freedom, and because of the freedom, you can reduce costs. Oh, that's one of the things. But obviously, most people in business step into it. I have to pay again to Microsoft. Let me get something free, cheap. And when users have the idea that their boss chooses something for them that's free because he don't want to pay them for their tools, that's not a good start.
No.
So that's why I said communication in a project to migrate to something as LibreOffice is very important, because people have to understand, okay, it is... you have to pay less, but we do spend money and we can have quality, and it's a good project as business
more
support,
etc.
Yes.
Is there anything else I missed or anything else that you want to talk to me about?
Well, how do you like our booth?
It's fantastic. It looks like a clothes shop, to be brutally honest with you.
It's like
a clothes shop.
Boutique. We had some difficulty in preparing the booth. We had some difficulties to choose. And so the fun is when you are at the booth with T-shirts, the developers pass, I already have a pile of T-shirts, but, give me another one. This year we choose for lovely V-neck T-shirts, different, and some hoodies, and also sweatshirts without hoodies, and some polo shirts. So that was the problem to choose, and that's what you see.
Cool.
But we have also lovely stickers and mugs and a great banner.
I'll include a picture. Go stand over there and I'll take a photo. Listen, thank you very much for the interview, and I look forward to talking to you later.
Thank you very much.
I'm talking to the Confine table. So, sorry, what's your name? And Roger, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Can you tell me about this? I'm just looking at your table and I see community-labs.net. There seems to be cell phones or something going on.
No, not at all. It's about community networks and research on community networks. Community networks are IP infrastructure built by the people for the people.
Yeah.
Mostly wireless. This is how it started, because it was the more affordable and available technology back in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Now we are moving into fiber as well.
Okay.
So extending the concept to fiber, it works as it did in Wi-Fi. And basically it's about people doing... and connecting it to the internet. So
where is this? Where did this start? Who had this idea?
I think it starts in parallel in many places. It started as questioning the privatization of internet that occurred back in the 90s.
Yeah.
So many people raised questions which were left unanswered. But the come up of Wi-Fi technologies was a good help there.
Yeah.
People start hacking the Linksys routers.
Yes.
The ad hoc mode also help, and then all this movement started. It's more, maybe people know it as wireless communities.
So like a mesh network or something like that?
Yeah, meshing is one way of doing this, but it's more about it's a conceptual thing. It's about going back to the roots to the internet, because people disagreed with what happened in the 90s and said, why not keeping the peering concept open and all this stuff.
So the idea would be here that a group of neighbors would join together, run network cable around, and then share an internet connection, or share their own internet connections.
They set up a network. That's all. I mean, to share contents.
Just internet, a local network?
Internet access comes afterwards.
Yes.
It's one of the services that you can have on top of this network. But you could think about other services.
So give me some examples of what's going on here.
Yeah, let's... Well, I come from Gifinet, so maybe first I can talk about this project. It's a project based... Well, it started in Catalonia, northeast Spain, back in 2003. And it started because some local farmers had the problem of internet access.
Yeah.
We are in the EU, so we had some rules to follow, and these guys had to report about how they feed the cattle every day, and they did not have internet access to do so.
Yeah.
So they start doing some research. They were used to solve their own problems
yeah.
in other fields, like water and roads and stuff like this. So why not going for the telecommunication infrastructure as well?
Yeah.
So and at that time, the Wi-Fi technology was starting to be accessible for the standard people.
Yeah.
And after travel one guy did to the States, they brought some wireless stuff to the country, and they said, why not using this? And they start using this. They solved their own problem, their specific problem, but the day after they realized that their neighbors had the same problem.
Yes.
So they taught them how they fix that problem. In parallel, they start talking to other people abroad that were thinking about this stuff and having same kind of problems. So, and this is how all started. At the moment, Gifinet has about 20,000 nodes, working nodes, most of them connected in the same cloud.
Yep.
And as I said, or maybe I didn't because I have already said this too many times these days, we are doing the same with fiber. I mean, it's we are technology agnostics. We don't care about technology too much. It's just a mean to achieve our purposes.
People who listen to Hacker Public Radio will be familiar with the Burn project in the UK, where we followed a group of farmers again who put down their own fiber network, dual-homed, using dynamite and loads of stuff. So we are familiar with the project. So what are the other two projects that you have here? Are they more or less the same thing?
There are three projects. They are all EU-funded projects.
Yep.
The Commission Fund gives some money for these projects. These projects are about to understand this new movement or this way of doing an alternative way of doing infrastructure. We have, on the one hand, Confine. It's a 4 years long project.
Yeah.
It's a fire project, an IP project. This means that it's for the future research infrastructure of the European Commission.
Yeah.
Maybe some of your listeners are familiar with the... the Planet Lab infrastructure. This is meant for researchers, and this is the same. It's an extension of the Planet Lab.
Yep.
We were inspired by this, but to extend this to the community networks. So basically, what we are doing, we have developed a full operating system to deploy tests on these devices. We spread this boxes among the community networks. This is an Atom-based device.
Yeah, just an Atom PC with a Wi-Fi network.
Yeah, and then researchers can run experiments on these devices to do some performance tests and to try to understand this community networks movement.
Why is this connected over here to a what looks like a Wi-Fi router?
Well, because as I said, we started with Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
So we now here we have a Ethernet link wire connecting this router device, which connects to the community network.
Yeah.
And we have the black box or this research device, what the so-called research device, which is where the researchers run their experiments.
Yeah.
So this is a pretty powerful device connected to a low-performance device, which is not even 80 euros worth router.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
And then we have another two projects. Commons for Europe project is more about to explaining the concept of openness to the local authorities. We have one part of the project is Code for Europe. It's about trying to promote open source among councils mostly.
Always a good thing.
Yeah. And the other part, which is the one we are more involved, is to try to promote open infrastructures, even more challenging.
Yeah, thing. That could be a... You're probably going to... Have you run into any issues with incumbent operators?
Yes, but fortunately we are under the coverage of the European regulations.
Yes.
So somehow it can be beneficial, I think the general evaluation is that it's beneficial to be under this framework.
Yeah.
The incumbents, according to this framework, the incumbents have the obligation to share infrastructures. Then there are some rules to do so, but we are using these,
okay,
these facilities.
Is this mostly for rural projects, or could also be within a city?
It's like what you said, that you are sharing this in commons.
Yeah.
So it's not about the origin of the people. This can be done in the cities. This can be done in rural areas.
Yeah.
Everywhere. I mean, it's a concept.
Okay, so it's like bringing the network couple, back to the people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. There will be obviously links to all of this in the show notes. Is there anything else that we've missed?
Yes, I would encourage people to start doing telcos in their hometowns, and this is possible. I mean, it's a proof of concept what we have done, but not only Gifinet, there are many other communities. Probably if people check, they will find a community network nearby their homes.
That they can join.
Yeah.
Is there a central place where, a global central place that they can go to check?
We are still just coordinating each other. For instance, this event in Potsdam, yesterday we had a meeting of do-it-yourself ISPs.
Yes.
That's one point. People trying to do alternative ways of ISPing.
Yeah.
That's cool. We have other specific gathering events, like in next May, there will be the Battle Mesh in Leipzig. Most of the community networks in at least Europe, and I would say all over the world, will be there.
Okay, good.
And then we have a special summit in autumn. It's called the International Summit for Community Wireless Networks, which is... Yeah, it's. I would strongly recommend this meeting for people to start with all this.
Okay, perfect. This is something very close to my heart, so I'm glad that you're here, and look forward to some progress on this. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time and attention.
Hi, this is Ken at Potsdam 2014. I'm on the K2 building, and I'm talking to Barros. Is that correct?
Pardon? Barrios, yes.
Barrios.
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 I read Barrios, but then again, I am
dyslexic.
Yeah,
but you're not the only one that read it.
So I'm wrong and you're right. Backup archiving recovery open source.
Exactly.
And your name is?
Jörg Steffens.
And what's your relationship with this project?
I have worked with Vespeculare for many years, and... in the beginning of 2013, we have decided to create an own fork and called it Barrios. And I have been initially also on this project.
Okay, and what is the project? What's the point?
The project is about backup systems in a heterogeneous network. So the server is normally running on Linux, but we have also clients for Windows, Mac OS, and of course the Solaris, HBOX, IEX, and so on and so on.
But kind of backups, nobody really does them, do they?
Pardon?
Nobody really does backups, do they?
But everybody wants to have a recovery option.
You only don't do backups once. So tell me, how difficult is it to install? What sort of, what do I need in order to do this? And how expensive is it?
Okay, it's not expensive because it's an open source product project.
What license is it under?
AGPL3.
Okay, very good.
And
does it run on any operating system, or is this complete, put in a CD and run?
We have an appliance built with Open Studio in a nightly build, but of course it's more for Linux distributions, and we have a package, pre-package for Debian, Ubuntu, CentOS, SUSE, RHEL, and so on and so on. So in principle, it's also easy to install it. You just include the repository from various.org and install it, the meta package Barrios, and you get a running backup system for the initial, for the system itself.
So it's not an operating system as such?
No, it's not an operating system. Okay.
Operating system, except that it's one-on-one operating system.
Now, my experience of backup solutions across the board, from NetWare to VMware, or to HBOS, across the board, Windows, Mac, they've all been very, very, very difficult to operate. Have you fixed that problem?
I hope so. That's at least has been our intention, that we can easily start by installing just the server software, having the first client already included, and then we have the option to include more and more clients. And it should be more or less identical for the different platforms to add another clients, as long as you concentrate on file backup. But we also have plugins, for example, Microsoft SQL, because it's a quite complicated part, and helping backup for other database systems.
Okay, and are you able to schedule various different snapshots, and do you do all that sort of jazz? Incremental backups, full backups.
Okay. This kind, yes, this is typical stuff we do at backups. We have full backups, we have differential, we have incremental. We have also something like virtual full backup, so incremental forever. You create your full backup once, and then after this only the incremental backup. But of course, if then the full backup someday broke, you got into a problem. So you can recreate a full backup on the server side from your initial full backup and your incrementals.
Okay. So what's the underlying technology? Where's the data saved? Tape or?
You can... Yeah, both. You can save it on the disk, but if you have a lot of data, it's normally cheaper to store it on tape, especially if you want to keep the data for 10 years or something like this, because you don't need the electricity to power up the hard disk all the time.
Okay. And how easy is it to run? Can you run me through the operating, the dashboard?
I can show it on this web interface, but you have the configuration and it's file-based, and if you add a client, you add in a section there or including some other files. So most of the things, the core functionality is done on the command line, on configuration files, but there's different web front ends. And at the moment, we are developing also, it's called Barbossa. It's a special font, and it's hopefully it's better than the existing ones.
Okay, very good. It's what made you choose the AGPL?
Oh, that's have not be really an option, because the project where we forked from Bacula has all been AGPL, and so we keep this license.
Okay, what was any particular reason for forking from Bacula?
Yes. Because there haven't happened much in the development of Bacula for the last years, and in the last year there haven't been a single commit to the Bacula project, and this is the reason to fork.
Okay. Bacula has been, my experience of it has been, it's a very good backup utility.
Yes.
But it's complicated to run.
Yeah. So we are also quite happy with the product Bacula, because we are already used it for several years, and as it doesn't continue the development, we decided to fork. By doing the fork, we are also trying to make it simpler to use. So we have a default configuration that really works and you can build on, and also added some commands that help you to show specific stuff. And of course, with the front ends we integrate, it's all to should get easier for other people to get used to it.
So since the fork, has there been a lot of activity on your project?
Yes. There are two people who work full time on it. So, and
who pays them?
This is Marco van Biering here to my right, and Philip to your back.
And do they, who funds their project? Who pays them?
data at the moment? Not much, but okay, there's also a company behind Barrios, so the Barrios company,
yeah.
And we hope to sell support and maintenance in the future. But at the moment, it's the development and to get a good product.
Yeah, I think you're on to something very important. I can see a business model there. Okay, is there anything else? Are there new releases coming up, or how can people help the community?
There are plenty of things to do, and we can improve it. Especially for me, myself, I've worked on the documentation to get it in a usable state. And if somebody wants to contribute, find errors in it, and just test it, and if you find errors, just create bug reports, and we will fix it, hopefully.
Cool stuff. Thank you very much for taking the time. Enjoy the rest of the show. And I'm here talking to
Joachim Lindborg,
Ralf Meijer,
and Edwin Mons,
and pretty much anybody else we can rope in. This is the XMPP and SIP, free as in speech, the real-time lounge Jabber XMPP. So who's going to tell me what XMPP and Jabber is?
I will do that. Jabber was the original project that was started in 1999 for you know, making sure that people didn't have to use multiple...
What does it do?
So that they didn't have to use multiple different instant messaging clients.
Gotcha, yes,
and it just to see if they could centralize it.
Yeah.
But the protocol evolved and basically was a way to connect endpoints and exchange structured information. So eventually people thought, okay, well, we can connect other things like machines and little devices, and that maps quite well on it. XMPP is the name of the protocols that were standardized with the IETF.
Yeah. And Jabber is the client then?
Jabber was the original project name and is still basically... you could compare it to the web versus HTTP.
Yeah.
So Jabber is more, all the technologies and the network and the clients, and whereas XMPP is just about the protocols.
The on-the-wire protocol. Okay,
yeah.
Very good. Did Google Talk support this and drop support recently?
Google Talk was one of the XMPP server implementations. Last May, Google decided that they wanted to redo their Hangouts.
Yeah.
So they are now in the process of whittling down their XMPP support there. And the current implementation doesn't really use XMPP anymore. So they have a legacy server that's still accessible for those domains that have an account with Google for their own domain. And you can opt to not upgrade to Hangouts, the new version.
So is that Hangouts an open protocol that you could use?
No.
Okay. And what license is XMPP under, or does it not need a license because it's open?
No, XMPP is a set of open protocols. The base protocols are standardized with the IETF. And the XMPP Standards Foundation is also a standards organization that is for doing extension protocols on top of the base protocols with the IETF. So we have a slightly different way of dealing with adding new protocol. It's slightly more agile than the IETF.
Why, that's probably a question for Google, but why didn't they just extend the XMPP protocol?
Actually, they did, and at first, and also the previous versions of Hangouts were built on a thing that's called Jingle. Jingle is a set of protocols to do session initiation between endpoints for media streams. They helped standardize it with us, and then... we are actually still quite in the dark why Google decided to move on.
Okay, we can't talk about their projects. So.
Yes.
So let's move on. What else do I see here then?
Well, yeah,
as a basis for when you have people talking to each other, they commute over a language. So they are chatting English, for example. Then they can talk to each other. So we now lever it down to the devices. So devices could start a chat to each other if they are friends. So your refrigerator could start to chat to you, telling it your door is open.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But then you need, if you talk to machine to machine, you need a language that actually talks data.
Okay, yeah.
So that's what we've done with the extensions. They're now a defined way of sending a temperature as a temperature which is interoperable in the other end.
Okay, I get
that. So the other machine can read it as a temperature.
Okay, well, I have some devices at home, and they, you know, they're off-the-shelf devices, and they're talking to loads of different things that I don't want them talking to. How do I make sure that the stuff that my solution was just put behind a firewall and that was that? But how do I own this myself? How do I own what's going on in my house?
Yeah, that's the problem today, that the providers of devices instantly get every data up to their cloud service.
Yes.
And that's where you possibly could access them, on a web page or on an open API if they are kind.
Yeah.
And what we'd like to do then is to open up the data as chat clients, which could be on any domain, in any kind of construction, either all the way down, so you set your ID on your domain on your device, which would be the exact focus on the far end.
Yeah.
But for now, we sort of go to the cloud API, reopen the data for you to use, and then you would be the one to set who's able to befriend to who.
But I would need to go through a cloud device.
You would need to be up in the, on the internet. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of these devices are basically their own walled garden, just like what you have with the social networking sites, like the Googles and the Facebooks and the Twitters. They like to control their own environment, and there is apparently no incentive yet to have common protocols for doing all kinds of home automation. There are some efforts in that direction, but it's still far away. So we now have to take the middle ground and see if we can bridge those protocols.
Okay. I would like to see a world where, like, my phone, I use a SIP provider. I've got a device from the ISP, and the only thing special they've done is put my SIP account with their service. I could equally remove that in the morning and use my own SIP provider. Is that like the goal? For I go to my toaster and I go to my fridge and I replace the cloud service that my fridge provides with my own cloud device. How easy is that going to be?
Well, depending on the providers, of course, and the kind of services they are selling. So as soon as there's a protocol that's easily accessible, people would build hardware without services because it's cheap, it's nice, it's easy to do. If you can buy them on the Conrad webpage without any service, that would be the way. But as far as the providers are selling you the thing with the service, they will never open it up for you.
Absolutely. Okay, well, it's not in their interest to do it. So what have I got here, and how does that link in with the conversation we've just had?
One product they're selling quite a lot is Philips Hue lamps, which is a Zigbee connected network with lamps. So you can set their temperature, light temperature, the color of them.
Yep.
And they have a web API on the local gateway.
Okay, just one sec.
They have
So for the listeners, what we're looking at here is four lamps that are in the roof, and they're from Philips, and they turn different colors.
Yes.
Cool. And that's a Zigbee connection down to a receiving device.
Yes.
So the receiving device is sitting on a network hub, and I see a Raspberry Pi. I see loads of other cool stuff.
Yeah, so the Raspberry Pi is connected to a local network together with the gateway.
Yep.
And then it has a connection up to internet as well.
Okay, yep.
So we have the gateway, which have a RESTful API, and it also have a cloud service as Philips.
Yeah, okay.
But we go
so I can still control it via Philips if I want.
Yeah, so you still have it in your phone or whatever. But what we now done is that on the HTTP interface, we glued XMPP on it. So therefore, each lamp has a JID, which is called the Jabber Identity on the Chatty Network.
Yeah.
So we have John, Ringo, the whole of Beatles are up in the roof. And if you're a friend with them, you can send them messages.
And define being a friend, as in you, you're a friend, as in chat friend.
Hey. As in chat friend.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay, cool.
So if you are a person, you could send a text message to it, for example, saying alert, which would Blink the lamp, which is what Ralph is doing.
Oh, yes, and I'm looking at an IRC client, and I need to ask you what IRC
client. Well, it's a Jabber client, yeah? This is MC Eber. It's a very IRC-like Jabber client.
Yep.
And what you see here is five contacts.
Yep.
One of them is called Beatles, and then we have John, Paul, Ringo, and George as individual ones. So if you send a message to the individual Beatles, you can set the U, you can set the saturation, and you can set the brightness of each of the lamps. And if you send a message to Beatles, then you do it for all of them at the same time.
Well, that's very good.
So there's a grouping mechanism in the U APIs. And the default is, the basic group is all lamps. So.
And you just communicate with them like you would a regular client.
You can see this, but there is you just send the text messages, U equal sign, and then a number from 0 to 64K. And that gives you the range of colors. And you can also say saturation from 0 to 54. That's, you know, if it's 0, then it's all white. And another, you get deeper colors.
So the integration here, this could be anything, really. I mean, you're using Philips lights, but that could be, feed the dog.
Yeah, so
coffee machine.
Yeah, coffee machine on.
So this is the protocol that you could use as a human.
Yeah. And the beauty is you're just leveraging Jabber, and anything that supports Jabber, you can be on work talking to your boss and then feed the dog at home or...
Exactly, yeah.
And the next level will be, you know, we are human to machine.
Yes.
But machine to machine, we would talk bare XML, which is an extensible part of the XMPP protocol.
Yep.
And you would have interoperable data XML transport of understandable data between machines.
So
that's the language for them.
Okay, hold on. Yeah.
So that's what we have over here.
Yep.
This machine here also has a connection called Yoko, and Yoko is able to control part of the Beatles. For instance, she is able...
Sorry, you're cracking me up too.
Yes, we had quite a bit of fun coming up with these names. So Yoko is able to flip off and on Paul. Now he's flipped off.
Yeah.
And now he's flipped on again.
And... Paul, you're able to do that via just a regular switch in through a breadboard into a Raspberry Pi. And what's on the Pi then? What's doing the magic there?
There's a small program running that was partially written by Joachim. I extended it a bit. That will look for signals on the GPIO bus to see if a switch was flipped or a light sensor, reading light sensors or distance sensors. Then translates that into events for these devices using XMPP. It sends machine-to-machine messages telling the lights to turn off and on again or change brightness. For instance, this one will slowly change the brightness of John over there. It's a bit slow. Because I didn't set the thresholds correctly.
But there's an audio podcast, so we can all go, oh, look, it's just dimmed down.
So, yes, indeed. So this is really showing off the machine-to-machine interoperability and human interaction that can trigger machine-to-machine interoperability.
Okay, so we have two other sensors here. What's this one?
That's moisture. So it could be under your dishwasher
to
see if it's leaking.
Okay.
And then you have distance.
Okay.
Ultrasonic distance measurement. So that could be perhaps the color, if you would like to have a color control of the thing as well.
Yes. Or actually, I live beside a graveyard, so I have had a plan for a long time to have a motion sensor, and when somebody goes past, that a coffin will creak and go, I'm not dead! But
you could use this technology to do that, to do exactly that.
Well, okay.
Could also talk to you on your chat window. So if you are at the work and somebody passes the graveyard, you can see a message and get a jingle, perhaps with a video signal, getting it back. Since it's also chatting, video messaging, conferencing, you can take part, for example, in a multi-user room where we could be talking to each other anonymously. And if you say that room is a smart city, every device could join in this multi-user room to discuss the power on the grid. for example. Okay. So if we are 10,000 electricity meters, anonymously we can talk in a multi-user room talking about our power.
Yes.
So if there's increased power in the room, you know that there's a lot of load on the electricity network in real time.
Okay.
Without revealing who you are, because in a multi-user room you can be anonymous.
Okay, and what's the authentication for this comes with the stuff that you get with XMPP, I'm guessing?
On XMPP, each server could decide on what kind of security it would like. You could use OAuth or just password names or certificates. It's up to you, the server. And the whole XMPP network is, during the spring today, hardening the whole network to not allow any unencrypted sessions. So we will enforce to use TLS all the way down to the client.
Thank you, NSA.
Yeah. And then the servers in between, when one domain talks to another domain, they have certificate interchange in peer-to-peer manner.
Yeah, okay, good.
So...
Okay, this is fantastic. So here we have the hardware talking to Raspberry Pi, and the Raspberry Pi talks to a Jabber or Jabberish client. And then the other part talking to the Philips, is that something that you're going to extend to other devices? Or say I've got my fridge, how do I get my fridge onto the game?
We have a very big project in Sweden, where I come from, and we do an energy efficiency project where we get the alarm systems connected to the same way to heating systems.
Okay.
Because it's very tricky to get an alarm company interoperable, communicate to a heating system's other silo. You can, of course, have two apps, one for the alarm and one for the heat pump, but to get a temperature from a smoke detector to a heating system. It's a very long way and a lot of integration projects, especially if there are 10 heat pump companies having 10 apps with 10 different APIs. This is a way for them to federate data over to any of those domains. So that's installed now in 20 villas in the Stockholm area, where they share data over the XMPP network as a peer-to-peer transport of data.
And the privacy issues are fixed by the fact that it's controlled.
And it's only between friends.
Yeah.
The next level would be that you actually have authorization on a special value. So if you're a friend to my alarm, reading smoke detector's temperature, I wouldn't let you read the status of the alarm.
And that's in development, is it?
Yeah, the idea there is that each client would have a best friend to ask for the level of authority. So if you are a friend of mine and you're asking me for the status, I would ask my best friend, my parent, am I allowed to give this man the status of the alarm?
Okay,
and that would, of course, say no.
That's a lot of development that you need to do still, a lot of integration.
Yeah, but the thing is with the XMPP is that it's one place where the standardization is done, and that is the XMPP Foundation. So these standards now are thrown out as experimental, so people use it, but it's only one pipe or where you could go to get them to draft. So everybody needs to do the same thing. So regardless of anybody is doing it, it will be interoperable if you concise to those standards.
So even if small provider of smoke alarms does it and a small provider of heat pumps does it, it's in their interest to do it because the more people will do it. But then together, I'm more inclined to buy the small provider's heat pump and the small provider's thing because I can integrate them with them.
Exactly.
That makes perfect sense to me.
So it's a little snowball that hopefully roll down the mountain to get big.
Yeah, it should do. Okay, is there anything else that I need to know?
Well, you can find more on it on xmpp.org.
Yeah, good.
And the project of energy efficiency is on iea.sust.se.
I'll get you to write that down in the notebook now in a second, and links will be in the show notes. Do you have the source code for the Raspberry Pi stuff?
Yes, they are on GitHub.
And do you have the schematics and stuff so that somebody could do it?
We will arrange that. It will probably be an everyday try out, do it this to control your home lamps.
Did I miss anything, or are we good?
I
think we're good.
How has the beer been?
Very nice. I'm very dry throat.
Yes. Okay, guys, thank you very much, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Cool lounge, and there's loads of video screens around, and I'm standing with Emil beside the Jitsi table. Tell me, what's Jitsi?
Jitsi is an open source project that allows you to do audio and video calls and video conferencing. Many people view it as an open source alternative to Skype or other such applications. It's been around for 10 years, and probably one of the most important features in Jitsi is the accent that we have on security, because we all of our calls are encrypted using SRDP. We support key negotiation protocols like ZRDP from Phil Zimmerman, and also DTLS SRDP, and we have OTR for end-to-end message encryption. That's a very important thing for us.
Okay, I have no idea what you said, but that was going to be my next question.
Okay.
Tell me, you've been gone for 10 years. How come what sort of license are you released under?
We're released under LGPL.
Okay.
Yes.
And how difficult is it to install, and on what platforms are you supported?
It's actually not difficult at all. We work on Windows, Linux, and Mac OS X, and you just download it. We're even in Debian since this summer, just go to jitsi.org and you download it and install it, and it runs on these operating systems. We have an Android version on the way. It's still in development, but it's coming along pretty nicely. And actually, a couple of months ago, we started working on a second project, which is what you see here on the stand. This is JitMeet. This application allows you to basically do open source Hangouts. It uses WebRTC on the client side, so you just need Chromium and Chrome, and it will soon support other WebRTC compatible browsers such as Firefox.
So
just go. Yeah.
Sorry, just I need to describe to people what we're looking at. So we're looking at a TV screen, and if I wave in there, the center screen comes up very much like pictures I've seen of Hangouts. I've never used Hangouts, but. And on the bottom, there are various other cameras. Where are they? There are different clients running, are they?
Yes, there's all of these clients here are participants in the conference.
Yeah.
So they're just sharing one single conference. And you could imagine those all over the world sharing the same conference and talking.
But WebRTC is a relatively new protocol, and you're already supporting that. So.
Yes.
How did you manage to do that so quick?
Actually, WebRTC, it is a relatively new technology, but it reuses a lot of existing standards for real-time communication, such as RTP, for example, ICE for non-traversal, DTLS SRDP. So the Jitsi's role here is really not that much into the client side, although the JitMeet application is currently handled by the Jitsi community. But what's really interesting here is the server side, the bridge that relays all the video streams, because every participant is just sending one video stream to the bridge, and then the bridge sends back all the video streams for all the other participants. And that bridge is actually the heart of Jitsi, moved to the server. That's why I call it the Jitsi Video Bridge. And it's very lightweight because it just relays video. It doesn't mix anything. It's so lightweight, actually, that this entire conference here is taking about 30% of this box here. That's where the bridge runs currently. It's
what sort of a device is that?
That's an Intel NUC. Okay. With an i3 processor, and we're hosting the conference on top of it. And we even have further optimizations, so it's going to be even more powerful.
So if I had a shared VPS, is that something that I could run on that?
A shared what, sorry?
I have a VPS, a virtual private server, one of those €9 a month.
Of course, yes. We actually have the Meet Jitsi service, meet.jit.si, where you can try it out. It runs on a VM somewhere in the network, and it's exactly what it's meant for. It's really lightweight, and obviously there's the service that we use just as an example, but you can download this whole thing from jitmeet.org, jitmeet.org.
Yeah.
You can install everything. We use the Prosody XMPP server, which is a very cool one, the Nginx web server, and
Okay, very good. And how complicated is it to?
No, that's okay. I think the...
Okay, fine. Do I need... I want to install Jitsi. Do I need an account or anything strange like that? How do I get my friends on? How do I get my mom and dad on?
If you want to get your mom and dad, I think JitMeet is going to be very easy for you, because you just point them to a URL. They don't need an account. You just point them there. It creates a conference for them. So you just need to take the link, the URL, and send it over email to everyone else. They click on it, and you're in a conference. That's it.
Yeah.
You don't need accounts. You don't need anything.
Yeah.
Jitsi itself is what is commonly known as a rich client.
Yeah.
So that you need to install, we need to connect to servers, you need to find an account somewhere. That is a more complicated process. Normally, either you have to know a little bit about these things in order to use it, or you have to have someone who deploys it for you. This is generally how people have been using it, which is indeed some sort of a limitation. Yeah. And that's why we are very, really very enthusiastic about Meet Jitsi, because it's really very easy to use. It's the simplest video conferencing experience that you're going to get ever. It's easier than Hangouts, too. It's easier than GoToMeeting or WebEx or whatever.
Okay, fantastic.
And it's entirely open source.
Excellent. Is there a company behind this, or are you just doing this for love?
There is a company behind this, but not as in any exclusive way. It's just that a bunch of the developers happen to be working for BlueJimp, which is a company that provides development services around Jitsi. So if some customers of ours are basically saying, oh yeah, this Jitsi is doing 95% of what we need, could you please add the thing that we're missing and that we really need for our use case? That's where we come in. And everything, most of the things that we develop are open source as well, and that's how the project grows and etc. And we have voluntary contributors as well, like some of us here. So the company doesn't really play some sort of a limiting role in the project.
Okay, fantastic. Anything else I missed on this whole thing? I know you need to disassemble everything, so.
Well, it would probably be good to point your listeners to your audience to the Lightning talk that we had yesterday, the Jitsi Video Bridge Lightning talk on FuzzDem. That would probably be of interest, and there's a recorded video, so they would be able to see more clearly what this is about.
Absolutely. I'll put a link into the show notes for this episode. Okay, thank you very much. And
thank you very much for stopping by.
Home.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi everybody, this is Ken. It's almost the end of FOSDEM 2014. This is the first time I've been here, and I'm talking to Jan Frederik Martens. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Hi everyone.
So, what's your involvement with FOSDEM? You're wearing a lovely yellow t-shirt.
Well, I'm one of the approximately 25 people organizing FOSDEM. We start each year around July, August, contacting people who might be interesting to present their findings, their projects during the main tracks. We also have a need for keynote speakers, and then once the months move on, we go into details, we go and look for developer rooms. As you might know, we have about 20, 22 developer rooms focused on a certain project, such as Fedora, and every developer room has their responsible making sure that the quality of the talks in that dev room is well as it should be.
So the developer room people pick the talks for that track?
That is correct. We have in total more than 400 presentations, so doing that ourselves would be not really feasible. We focus on the keynotes, the main tracks, and the lightning talks, but we leave the review of the developer room's talk to the developer room responsibles.
So how many talks do you have to make sure are organized then?
Well, we ourselves do about 20 main track talks and about 20 lightning talks in total as well.
Okay. This has to be the biggest event that I've ever been at, and the organization is military in its efficiency. How have you managed to do that? Did that happen overnight, or is it just incremental improvements?
It's trial and error. The first FOSDEM, which back in the day was called OSDEM, was in 2000. And I can assure you, we didn't do things as professionally back then as we do now. It's a matter of learning, listening to the remarks of visitors, getting great input from all kinds of sources, having a larger team to help out, having more financial possibilities as well, with sponsorship, with donations, which of course much appreciate from our visitors. And well, this is the 14th edition right now. And a lot of the organizers have been active in the organization since 2003. So we have a lot of know-how and a super efficient and motivated team of staff. And let's not forget the volunteers, because the volunteer group is even larger than the core staff group.
How many volunteers are there?
I would say about 100 over the weekend.
And they're everywhere. Like I interviewed some of the guys down taking cloaks, and they're like developers of main projects, and they're there putting up with grief from people like me looking for my coat. Absolutely fantastic. One of the things, though, you were very, very lucky in getting the building.
Oh yes, we're very thankful to the Université Libre de Belgique, so the university that we are right here. We have started in 2000 in another campus of theirs, and in 2001, if I'm not mistaken, there goes some bottles.
Don't worry, folks, those are empty beer bottles. No need to panic.
So in 2001, I believe, we moved to the Solbosch campus, which was at the time quite a small event, just one single building, a couple of rooms, and we grew and we grew. And the first years, we got the assistance from the Cercle Informatique, which is a local student organization, and we were able to book the rooms through them. But as we grew, we got into contact with the ULB directly. The ULB noticed that there were quite a lot of people during the first weekend or the second weekend of February each year. And so they were wondering, who are you? What are you doing here? And we have a very good relationship with them.
It's just mind-blowing when I arrived off the train. Mm-hmm. I've told the story. There's this woman on the tram, and she had no idea. She just looked out and suddenly the tram was empty of all these people. Must have thought it was a flash mob or something. So what happens next? What's the cleanup? Are you finished? When are you going to be finished tonight?
Hopefully we'll be finished by approximately 9 or 9:30 p.m. At 4, which is half an hour ago, we start removing the signalization. We start closing the first developer rooms. Then we need to move on to the individual buildings, close them one by one, clean them, making sure that all the equipment that we have there, ranging from cleaning gear to video equipment, audio equipment, tables, chairs, everything which is not located normally at the university, has been put in a central location so that the renting companies can come and pick it up on Monday. It will be a stressful couple of hours.
I don't think people appreciate the logistic nightmare that this is. And so I'm not going to take too much more of your time. I just want to say from everybody who has participated in FOSDEM, thank you very much. Absolutely brilliant, brilliant thing that you're doing for the community.
Yeah, it's not just us. Let's not forget about the volunteers, the ULB, the Cercle Informatique, and in fact all people involved in the organization of FOSDEM.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.